In today's episode, we welcome Stefan Mork to the podcast. Stefan gives us an overview of his career, which has spanned from the AIS into the A-League, into Europe, back to the A-League, and now carving out a great career in Japan and pushing for promotion. We talk about the early days at the AIS and getting signed at Melbourne City, back when they started in the A-League in 2013, his moves to Adelaide, and then his moves overseas, and a lot of ins and outs around that move and things to be aware of moving forward. Also how to deal with the mental side of the game, mental toughness and resilience. After starting his first game over in Holland, he was taken off at halftime and rarely played for the rest of the season. A lot of really great stories and insights. Stefan really shared a lot of information with us, which I really appreciate. I thought it was a fantastic chat, and I really look forward to bringing it for you. Well, good morning, Stefan, and thank you very much for joining us on the Overseas Athlete Podcast. It's great to have you on here.
Thanks for having me, and looking forward to the chat.
Yeah, it's been a while in the works, so it's good to finally get you on here and catch up.
Yeah, it's always a little bit difficult with the football schedule that's kind of constantly changing, and then the other stuff that I'm doing outside, and then I'm sure yourself as well with your busy life, but we're finally here.
Yeah, no, definitely. No, well, mate, I'll start with, the nice and simple part is a little bit about, you know, your background and who you are and where you are now and sort of where you came from and how you got there.
Yeah, I guess, firstly, I'm a football player by trade. That's my job. But, for me as a person, I guess I've kind of evolved over the years. And what I probably first thought was, when I was 14, 15, 16, up until, I reckon 21 was I was a footballer and that was it. But I'm obviously much, much more than that. And so now I try and, I guess, speak to that question and say that, I'm someone that likes to inspire other people to be the best they can be. In whatever it is they're doing, so that's what I do. I play football, and that's one of the ways I try and do that. I grew up in Adelaide, a young boy playing a range of different sports. Anything that kind of got me outdoors, I loved. And it wasn't until I was about 15 years old that things started to really go in a positive way for I guess being a professional athlete and moving over to the Australian Institute of Sport, getting my first contract. In the A-League, getting a move overseas and then kind of floating around different A-League teams, becoming the captain at Adelaide and now being over here in Japan. So that's obviously a very quick version of how everything kind of transpired, but that's really it.
Awesome. So what you mentioned there about until you got to 15, so obviously nowadays, and I know you're not old, but we've got sort of the NPL systems here that start from under nines, and you've got kids training, four nights a week and then doing private academies, and they've got private sessions. So is that a little bit different for you? Was your focus just sports, just being active, playing sports? And why was it sort of 15? Was it something that changed in you, or something that just changed in general for you to sort of kick on and go, yeah, I want to be a professional footballer?
Well, firstly, I guess I am getting old now, 27, so I'm getting there in football terms of being old. But yeah, I think looking back, it was probably more so just the recognition. I didn't make any of the state teams until I was 14. I missed out on, from under 12s, 13s, 14s, 15s, I missed out on that. Then got called back into the under 15 squad halfway through that season to go away to Coffs Harbour. And I guess I always believed in myself. I always thought I was good enough. In the backyard, always kind of imagining scoring the winning goal for Arsenal or the Socceroos or whatever it may be. But probably just that recognition and being a young kid, you do have belief in yourself, but at the same time, you get belief from a lot of external things by making certain squads or being told you're a good player. And I guess I just hadn't really had that. At that state level anyway, which for me was the top level you could be at that moment. So that's probably what it was a little bit. And then in terms of when you spoke about, the system now with the SAP and training three nights a week, private academies, and that wasn't a massive focus back in the day. Like I don't even know how many private academies there was a guy that I used to go and see, I think, probably, 10 times I reckon I went there. So it wasn't very often throughout my junior career. But And even the NPL training at Adelaide City was twice a week. So it wasn't as intense as what it is now. But I think it's a really good thing with the amount that the young kids are training now, because I do think, you know, how much better could I have been if I was training in that environment? But also then there comes a point where, you know, you can't be just focusing on the on-field, you know, training more and kind of making these kids believe they're going to maybe make it because they're doing that. I think that there has to be a balance. And then obviously the quality of training is just as important as well.
And with those sort of state teams that you'd missed out on, say under 12s, 13s, 14s, et cetera, was there anything in particular? Was it a physicality thing for you, or was it an ability thing? Like, did you get feedback on it, or was that just something you had to work through?
No feedback, which is pretty poor, I think. And I understand there's a lot of kids trialing in the system. I'm sure the way it is now, well, I don't actually think it's any better, because that's something that I'm doing on the side, which is trying to give clubs and stuff a platform to actually give feedback. But yeah, there was no feedback. I think, to be honest, the first couple of years, 12s and 13s, I was a smaller kid. I probably was a little bit shy in, you know, when I was in a setting that I wasn't comfortable in. So I maybe wasn't, you know, maybe didn't trial as well. And I was probably similar to what I am now, more of a team player, where I'd get the ball, look to kind of, you know, pass and link up, where maybe some other kids were getting the ball, trying to dribble past four or five players, and that's what they were looking for. I honestly couldn't tell you too much, but I think that's where the system, I hope, in terms of how players are selected, is a lot better now, and they're actually going out to watch them in their club environments and speaking to the club coaches a lot more. But also, you know, what I've come to understand in football at the top level, when it goes all the way down, is it's a matter of opinions, this game, and that's what's great about it, you know. But it also means that some coaches don't see you or don't hold you in you know, that high level of players compared to someone else, and that's something you have to accept as well, that, you know, you're not always going to be looked at as one of the better players by a coach.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I actually love the fact that you didn't make any of those state teams, but now when you look at it, you're playing full-time professional football in Japan. So it just goes to show that if you are a bit smaller or you get missed out because someone doesn't like the way you play, you just have to keep sort of plugging away, because someone will, you know, eventually someone will like the way you play, they'll like your attitude, and as long as you keep working hard and putting the effort in. So, yeah, that's fantastic, mate. That's awesome.
Yeah, I think that's probably a lot of those setbacks early on in my career. You know, at the time I obviously was devastated, and I probably wasn't looking at them as a good thing at all. But that resilience that you build from, you know, maybe getting told you're not good enough and having to work that little bit harder makes you appreciate when things are going well, or you do make the state team, or you do get that first setback in a professional setup, for example, you can handle it because you've had to do that your whole junior career. And I think that's something that is really important for clubs to be teaching young players as players, but as people as well, is that, you know, you're going to get these setbacks, that they're inevitable. It doesn't matter who you are. You're always going to, you know, fail. You're going to get dropped from a team, left out of a squad. But kind of equipping these players with the tools to be able to handle that is just as important. So even if, you know, you do get your son or daughter gets cut from a team, hopefully they can walk away and go to the next team, and they've learned something from that as to, you know, what they need to improve on or how they can handle that situation. Because as you'd know, life's tough, whether it's sport or whether it's life. You know, there's no easy passage to being successful. So that's part and parcel of it.
Yeah, no, definitely. Couldn't agree more. And then I'll jump into your time at AIS. How did that come about, and how long were you with the AIS?
Yeah, so I was there for about 20 months, just under 2 years. And from Coffs Harbour, we then had another tournament, which was the NTC Challenge in Canberra. And from that, the top 10 or 11 players got selected to, I guess, take a scholarship if they wanted it. And I was fortunate that I was one of those players, you know, so I went from not being good enough for my state team 6 months earlier to being in the top 10 or 11 in the country because of a different coach. So it's funny how quickly it can change. But yeah, going away to the AIS was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, I think, just because it got me out of, you know, my comfort zone in Adelaide, got me away from my family, which was, you know, my family were great. But I think, you know, you have to become so much more independent, you know, waking up on your own, going down to the dining hall, having breakfast, getting onto the school bus, getting to gym, getting to training. You know, everything was walking distance, or, you know, you get on the AIS bus to get to school. But it was up to you to actually, you know, set your alarm to wake up. You know, you didn't have your parents there kind of saying, come on, we've got to go, or you got to eat, or you got to do this. So you started to understand, you know, what it takes to, I guess, be on your own and to still be successful. And then the second part to it was you're exposed to, you know, nutritionists, sports psychologists, strength and conditioning programs, physios, masseuses. So it wasn't just a rock up to training, train, go home. That's it. It was like, no, this is a 24/7 job almost. And, you know, sleep's the best form of recovery. So even though sleeping, you're not doing much, that's part of being an athlete. And eating, what are you eating? What choices are you making? So I learned about all of those things, which, you know, some players probably didn't take advantage of and didn't care about. Others did. And I think now with the way a professional athlete has to live their life, you know, that stuff there is just as important as what you're doing on the field.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely is. And did you find, because I had Cam Watson on here chatting a couple of weeks ago, and he went through the AIS as well. I think he's a couple of years older than you, probably about 10 actually. But he said it sort of got him prepared. He said it really got him prepared for the amount of load and the amount of training that you guys done there, and also like that, the sort of off the field discipline of getting yourself ready, getting yourself prepared. So did you find that as well? Was it from a, just like a, took you to the next level in regards of your, I guess, physicality, but football as well?
Yeah, potentially. I think before that, you know, training with the state team, the NT, I think by then I was with, it was Sassy back then before the NTC program came into the South Australian Sports Institute. But I think we trained 3 or 4 nights a week. I can't remember exactly, but going to the AIS definitely was, you know, pretty much you had every day of the week training or recovery or gym. And that was a really good, next step up to kind of see if your body can handle it. And when I was there was a few players that actually had groin problems, and they did taper off with some of the training, which I think we need to train harder, especially coming here to Japan and seeing the way they train. I think we can train harder in Australia from a younger age, but you do need to actually make the players be able to handle the loads first, and that starts from a younger age. But it definitely set me up for going into that professional environment so my body could handle it, and just understanding, you know, what it takes to be a professional athlete. Because at the AIS, you know, you were surrounded by, you know, people that were trying to get to the Olympics as well in all different sports. So, you know, we were pretty much professional athletes in everything we were doing, besides the paycheck going into our bank accounts was non-existent, obviously, as a 15, 16-year-old. But everything else was, you know, was living like a professional athlete. So when I did get that professional contract, I was ready to accept that and go there and kind of handle everything, even though there was other challenges. But, you know, I was ready to kind of live that same lifestyle.
And did it really hit home for you, the just sort of what you mentioned there, but the training and the recovery, like, and the nutrition, did you really take that in at that age? Because you're still a 15, 16-year-old kid. Did you realize how important it was, or did it take a while for you to sort of realize how important that was?
No, not really, to be honest. I can't tell you why I was like that, but I was like a sponge, I guess, trying to soak up everything and to be really committed. And I remember in the first few weeks, we had a presentation from one of the players that was just leaving to go and sign a professional contract. He was a couple of years older. And he kind of spoke to all the players about, you know, the percentage of players that actually go on and get a professional contract from this, and the ones that actually beyond that go and have a career. And it was such a small percentage, like it was 20-30%. Which is, you know, not what you expect when you've got the top 20 best players for 2 age groups in Australia. You think they'd all go on and have a professional career. But I guess that really showed me that not everyone's guaranteed to make it. So why are you going to be different from, you know, the bloke sitting next to you? And that made me really just commit to myself more than anything, was that, you know what, I wouldn't have been happy if I didn't make it, but I think I could have lived with myself knowing that I gave everything and I just wasn't good enough. But, you know, I wanted to make sure that I was leaving no stone unturned in that pursuit of becoming a professional athlete. So you know, I wasn't perfect. What I thought was great back then is probably I'm a lot better now with certain things, but, you know, what I was eating, what time I was going to bed, doing recovery, you know, for me, that's the fundamentals. And that's kind of, you know, people speak about that as, you know, that's great, you know, to do these extra things. And, you know, I'm getting a level up compared to the person next to me. But I look at it and think that that's just part of the job. Like that's what you should be doing. Like there's no reason why you shouldn't be doing that if you want to be a professional athlete. Especially now with how many games you play, the training levels, how intense it is. If you want to get to the top, you know, these are unbelievable athletes. So if you want to compete with them around the world, you know, you get out there, you're not just competing with Australian players, you're competing with players from every country in the world who's aspiring to be a professional footballer anyway.
Yeah, that's it. There's very, very low chance, as you say, to begin with, but unless you give yourself the best opportunity by doing all those right things, it's going to become extremely difficult to one day do it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. So, you know, you don't know what you don't know as well. And that's why I think educating players from a young age and you know what, when they're young, like you said, even me as a 14, 15 year old, you don't take in some things, but it might be 3 or 4 years down the track when that message from someone finally kind of sparks in your brain and you think, ah, that's what he was talking about. And you've actually educated them, maybe not for that moment, but for 3 or 4 years down the track. And I think it's so important, to provide everything to young players, because, you know, you want to give them every opportunity. And yes, it's great if they can go out and take initiative and look for things themselves. But, you know, whether it's, you know, a club or an academy or a state body, you know, you want to provide them with everything, you know, to give them the best chance in succeeding.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely agree. Well, back onto yourself. So how did the first professional deal come through? So you're currently with the AIS, and is that where it came from? How did you get a professional deal with Adelaide back then?
So it was actually Melbourne Heart where I went to first, Melbourne Heart and then turning into Melbourne City. And it all came about from, I don't actually know 100% how it came, but we played in the youth league back then, the AIS. So I guess when we're playing against the A-League youth teams, there was always the youth coaches or, you know, the first team coach possibly being there. And I got invited to go out to trial with Melbourne Heart when John Aloisi was the coach. Myself, Ben Garuccio and Scott Galloway, who are all three of us are professionals and have been since that time, got asked to go on trial for them. And myself and Ben both got a contract from that. Scotty unfortunately didn't, but then a few months later got one with Melbourne Victory. So yeah, the trial process was going away with them to Lismore for a week, I think it was. And then, you know, a couple months later, a contract offer came through, and I guess you had the chance then to either see out your 2 years at the AIS or accept that in the moment. And I was pretty keen to get out of there as quick as possible. And, you know, I wanted to be a professional footballer. So that was all I was worried about. And, you know, that first transition period was tough because, you know, you went from being at the AIS where as much as you had to be independent and self-sufficient with a lot of things, you know, they still did help you with a lot. Where going to Melbourne, I was living with another player who was a couple of years older, but I didn't have my driver's license, didn't know how to cook too well. I maybe had 3 or 4 meals down packed. But you started to, you know, have to do everything yourself, go shopping for groceries yourself, cook yourself. Obviously, I was doing my own washing anyway, so that wasn't too hard. Getting to training, whether it was, you know, getting a lift with someone or getting the public transport, you know, all these small little challenges, you know, being a 16-year-old, almost 17-year-old kid in Melbourne, and look back now, you know, I was a baby at the time compared to who I am now, but, you know, you managed to get by, and it was such a great learning experience.
Yeah, no, it would be, especially at that age, and I wouldn't even have thought of that, not having a driver's license when you're having to get around. But like that, as you say, you make do, don't you? You make it happen.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, most of the times I was getting picked up from other players, but if I had an early physio time or had a, you know, maybe a youth team training in the afternoon that I needed to get to or whatever it was, you know, you figure it out. And I think that's something that's really important for young adults, not just athletes, is to, you know, to be able to do that stuff. You know, it's great to have your parent there figuring things out for you or whoever it may be, but, you know, it's not difficult to do. You just have to try. And you know what's the worst thing that's going to happen? You get on the wrong train and late for training one time, which ended up happening to me once, and then the bad traffic in Melbourne got stuck on the tram, which wasn't great. So I was late for training one time and actually did get punished for that, which was a very harsh learning experience. But again, I was never late from that moment onwards. So, you know, you just learn and you make mistakes along the way, but you know, that's all part of growing up, isn't it?
Definitely, definitely. And like that, as you say, you make those mistakes, you don't make them again. So it's, you need the punishment, unfortunately, sometimes, because it does. It makes you learn. It makes you learn a lot quicker as well. And when the contract was sort of given to you, so thinking that you're a 16-year-old and Melbourne Heart have offered you a professional contract, at that point, because you've come out of the AIS, were you around agents at all, or was this something that you and your parents went through together?
I didn't have an agent at the time. And to be honest, my mum, she didn't. I think I would have sent it to her, but I don't know if she gave too much advice on it. I think I sent it maybe to the PFA from memory, but I'm not 100%. I reckon maybe I sent it to the PFA and said, "Oh, is this okay?" But you know, like it was a 1 year youth kind of into a 2 year. Professional contract. That's how it was back then, and you know, the money was. I think the minimum wage back then was maybe 40,000. I reckon it was. So you know, it wasn't a lot of money, but you know, for a 16-17-year-old kid, you know, it was a lot more money than I'd ever seen before. So you know, I didn't really care, and I was happy to just get my foot in the door. And the PFA, I guess, ticked it off and said everything was okay. And then from that moment onwards, I guess that's when. And you know, you get exposed to agents beyond that.
Yeah, no, definitely. We've had a chat with a few people that like that reach out to the PFO when they can. We know, you know, we do a lot of work with them. We know it's a really good supportive service. So it's good, especially with the young ones, as you say, if you're not exposed to agents and your parents, as much as they'd love to help you, if they're not used to it, they don't understand it, they don't know what they're looking for, it's good to have a, you know, another support system in place there. So you've spent a bit of time there at Melbourne Heart, which, as you said, became Melbourne City. 6 months stint with Adelaide, and then you moved to Holland. So if you want to just sort of dive into how all that came about, what age you were, you know, then, and how that process worked from, you know, a young kid obviously playing in the A-League to getting a deal overseas.
Yeah, so like you said, was at Melbourne City, Melbourne Heart for 4 years, went to Adelaide, did really well there, won the championship, and then I guess I had ambitions to go overseas. My agent was Vince Grella at the time, who's now the I think football director, president of Catania in Serie C. So he's changed paths, but you know, he was someone that I played with for half a season at Melbourne Heart. He became an agent, and I guess being a top level player, I didn't really speak to many agents before him. But I trusted him as a person, and I think that's probably the most important thing when you do have an agent. And I think, you know, when you're younger, they're not that. Yes, they can help, but at the same time, if you're a good player, you're going to get a contract. Once you start playing in the A-League, then it's important to, you know, to maybe have an agent to get a move overseas. But if you're in the youth team, you're in that setup, I really don't think it's that necessary. It's probably not until you do start playing and then making sure that the person that you're going with, yes, you want them to be well connected, but you want to trust them as well, because hopefully you're only going to have one agent for your career, and they're going to be making some pretty big decisions along with yourself and your family. So we had the idea that, you know, to go overseas at the end of that season, and there was a couple of teams interested. One of the teams, NEC Nijmegen in Holland, was, I guess, actually the lowest wage out of the other couple of teams, but it was probably the best chance to go and play there from what we thought. And for me, that was the most important. Go there, kind of, you know, start again, making a name for yourself in Europe and then move on to bigger and better things. That was the plan. And, you know, got a phone call from the agent saying that they're interested. Just then have to talk about, you know, the transfer fee, wages, all those small things. But once we decided on them, then it was just activating the buyout clause that I had in the contract at Adelaide. So without a buyout clause, obviously the A-League club can ask for as much as they want. You have a buyout clause in there, and then, you know, once they hit that price, no matter what, that club can't stop you. So I think that's an important thing to have in contracts when you're younger. As long as it's at a reasonable price, some clubs will probably try and put it ridiculously high, and then it's not very favorable for you because that's kind of the benchmark they've set. But again, if you want to get that move, I think as a player, you have a lot of power to kind of push through those things. So they activated the buyout clause, and then things moved pretty rapidly from there. And within a matter of, you know, 1 to 2 weeks, preseason had just started at Adelaide. I was on a plane heading over to NEC and to, I guess, you know, making that first step. And that's how it all came about.
So just on a couple of things that you mentioned there, initially then when you had a plan to go overseas, did you sort of engage Vince first and say, look, Vince, this is what I want to do? And then he went out sort of on your behalf to find a couple of contacts and a couple of clubs that might be interested?
No. So I guess, you know, I always wanted to go overseas, but once he finished playing and retired through injury, he's the one that actually contacted me and said, listen, I'm actually going to become an agent. I'm joining with a group in or organization in the UK, Base Soccer, which is a massive organization. I'm going to be looking after some Australian players and I want you to be first player. So that was kind of how that came about. And I guess from that moment onwards, you know, he always wanted me to get overseas because, you know, it's a lot more money overseas. It's better for your career. So the intention was always to get overseas. And I think it was just waiting for the, you know, playing well enough, playing, you know, enough games, being ready, having a team that actually is going to pay a transfer fee. That was kind of how that all came about.
And the buyout clause that you mentioned, how did that come about in the beginning? Is that something that you put into your initial Adelaide contract, or is that something, yeah, how did that come about? That's quite interesting.
Yeah, so that was, I guess, Vince, when I signed with Adelaide, I signed halfway through one of the seasons. I was away with the Ollie Roos actually, and got a call from Vince saying, would you be interested in going to Adelaide? Melbourne City wanted a player from Adelaide, Osama Malik, and Adelaide didn't want to let him go unless they got someone in return, and they asked for me, and I was coming off contract at Melbourne City at the end of that season, and I was playing, actually played almost every game for Melbourne City that season, but I was playing on the wing or sometimes in the midfield. We had a pretty good squad, so it was kind of, you know, you just play where you can kind of get a starting spot, and Adelaide were promising more midfield minutes, and I thought, you know what, if Melbourne City don't value me and they don't want to kind of commit to me for the years beyond that as well, playing in my position that I wanted to play in, maybe it is a good chance to get to Adelaide. And turned out to be a pretty good move. And in that move, you know, when you're negotiating your contract, Vince wanted to put in a buyout clause, which was relatively low, not too high, but I guess for Adelaide, they were getting me for not a massive, yeah, it was obviously a free transfer, but the wages weren't ridiculous. And I guess they probably didn't expect me to do so well so quickly. So, you know, worked out really well for me. And I think for Adelaide as well, they got a decent sized transfer fee for a player that played for them for 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. Cause I guess, you know, you concentrate on playing and that's what you want to do. I suppose in the back of your mind, you have to think sometimes that, you know, football is a business now. So there has to be some sort of transaction that works for the club at some point. So yeah, it's really interesting. The first time I know about buyout clauses, but the first player that sort of spoke to you that had one, or that's come up. So yeah, it's an interesting thing to sort of have in there, knowing that, yeah, you can't be blocked, I guess, if that was the case a little bit further down the line.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, you see a lot of these crazy fees that players get sold for, you know, in the Premier League and different Saudi Arabia, especially now as well. You know, they pay ridiculous fees. And if you don't have a buyout clause, then the club can essentially just, they can say whatever they want and not let you go until they reach that price or they're happy. Or if you have the buyout clause, I guess you got a little bit more security in knowing that, okay, this is the price that I need the club. So if you're an agent, for example, you can go and be talking to clubs and saying, I've got, you know, Stefan Mork, attacking midfield player. This is what wages we want. This is the transfer fee that I guarantee you'll get him for. So this is your total package where, you know, you try and sign another player. You don't know the buyout clause or you don't know the transfer fee. Club could say, yeah, we'll accept a, 500,000 Aussie. And then, you know, they realize it's a bigger club and maybe then they say, ah, we want 800,000 now. So I guess you don't know what they're actually going to ask for with the player. Or, you know, if I have a really good season and score 15 goals or 10 goals, they might say, we thought you were worth 700, but now you're worth 1.5 million. Where if your buyout clause is 500, 600, you're the same because they've been paying you the same wages, I guess. So there's different ways it can work out, but you don't want to sign, you know, a contract where your buyout clause is too high either. So it's kind of, you know, you have to be comfortable with that as the player, and that's hopefully where the agent's guiding you as well in the right way.
Yeah, so you were fully aware of, you sort of had those discussions with your agent to go, all right, yeah, we're happy with this, sounds like a reasonable figure, we'll put it in.
Yeah, he kind of sent over the contract. He said, this is, I guess I trusted Vince as well, probably a little bit blindly, which is a good thing because he always did well by me. With some other agents, maybe you've got to be careful. But yeah, he showed me the contract. This is the wages. This is the bike. Like, probably the two things that I looked at in the maybe 20 odd pages were the wages and the buyout clause. The rest of it was irrelevant to me, was all, obviously a lot of important things in there that you probably should read. But the A-League contracts are pretty standardized, so you know they're okay. So it's more so about the wages and the buyout clause.
Excellent. And then how did the sort of contract negotiations go with the NEC then in Holland? Again, no doubt Vince will take point on that, but did you have much say in what they were offering? Was there negotiations, or did you feel comfortable with how it all ran?
I feel comfortable because of Vince being comfortable with it. He flew over there. He's based in Italy, or even back then he was based in Italy. So he flew over there and spoke to the club, spoke to the coach. And for me, it was more about going somewhere where, you know, I thought it was going to be a good move, for me playing. The finances, they weren't that great, to be honest, back then. You know, I probably could have got more if I even tried to, you know, get a new deal in Australia. But, you know, I wanted to go to Europe. I wanted to go to a place where I thought I was going to have a good chance in playing, and that was really, you know, where my thought process was. Of course, Vince is going to try and get me the most amount of money as possible, but also, you know, they've only got a certain budget. They can't budge too much, you know. Once you know this is what it is, if, you know, they're offering a price, you know, maybe they can go up 10%, 15%, but they're not going to be able to, you know, double what you're asking for, type of thing. It just wasn't possible. So for me, it was enough money to live off and obviously to save a little bit of it and foot in the door in Europe. So that's all I was really worried about.
Yeah, no, definitely. And you don't want to blow it up by being greedy. As you say, your ambition is to play in Europe. As long as you can, you know, pay the bills and get by and save a bit of money, and that's it. It's a stepping stone, isn't it? And then you go, all right, well, I'll go there. I'll prove myself and hopefully, you know, be successful and things take care of themselves. And was there much that you had to do from this end? So was that a quick turnaround in regards to the sort of contracts, yourself getting on a plane to Holland, visas, that type of thing? Did you have to sort of worry about too much?
Not really too much. It was pretty simple. Once the fee had been agreed with Adelaide, there was nothing they could do. And then it was just about, all right, well, when can you fly over? When can you get your bags packed? I've got a German passport, so the visa thing was no issue. And then, it was pretty quick, like maybe a week or so, I reckon, the turnaround. And it was obviously a very exciting time as well, to get over there.
Fantastic. And the what was your first impressions when you sort of got there, got to the club, done a bit of training? What were your thoughts in regards to what you'd left in Australia to arriving over there?
Yeah, I guess everything was pretty positive. I didn't really know what to expect. I was, you know, for the first month or 6 weeks, I was living in a hotel, which was not ideal. But probably from the playing side of things, it was tough. Like the training level was higher, on training loads, especially. The coach was very, very demanding. And that was probably the thing that took me back most, you know, the A-League level. You know, not that it wasn't a good level, it was just easier training. I think, you know, sports science was a lot bigger in the A-League back then than what it was in Europe. So it was kind of like, especially the lower teams didn't have the budget for it. So it was just train as hard as you can with this coach, which I don't think was the right way to be. But, you know, for me as a player, especially, you know, I wasn't used to those levels. So I was sore every day and kind of just getting by, which is not ideal. But also, you know, you have to adapt pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I guess you don't have, I mean, even now thinking, what could you have done? You know, you didn't have enough time for you to do it, but what would you advise if someone who is playing, just say youth league or youth A-League level or now in the A-League and looking to move abroad, what sort of advice would you give them around the loads and the training to try and get them somewhat used to it?
Yeah, it's a tough one because, you know, that, you know, I was doing, you know, extra stuff outside, going to see someone to do gym work. So I was quite strong, you know, in the A-League, you know, my levels, you know, running in the games was very high in the A-League. I was, you know, in Adelaide when I was there, you know, my distance was always one of the highest. High speed was always quite good, but it was just because that was controlled training as well. So, you know, you're priming for the match, where over there it was just, you know, training hard every day and, just expecting you to be able to perform on the match day at that same level when, you know, you were maybe fatigued. I don't know how the other players felt, but because we hadn't trained at that level, it was very hard. So I think, you know, training more on your own when you're younger is going to have your body in a condition to be able to handle those loads. And even in the A-League, you know, if you don't feel like you're training hard enough and you can do more, there's a fine line between, I guess, you know, overloading and getting injury, but you do want to push yourself as well. So if you do go there, you can handle the loads. And that's something that, you know, I couldn't have probably changed too much on my own, but if I went back to 14, 15, you know, until I was at 20 years of age, I probably would have been doing a lot more on my own outside just to, compensate for the ease. It wasn't easy training in the A-League, but controlled training anyway.
Yeah, compared to that just constant high intensity day after day.
Yeah.
And did you find when you first went there, you say you're a little bit sore, did you manage injuries okay when you felt like that first sort of 4 to 6 weeks where the load does increase so much?
Yeah, I didn't. I remember I was extremely sore every day and fortunately I didn't get any injuries, which is probably, you know, a testament to, you know, the work I had done so my body could handle it, but I just couldn't produce the power in the training day after day. And probably mentally as well, I think, you know, that's such a big component of being able to train at a good level and a high level, even when you are sore. And I thought I was mentally quite tough until I went there. But, you know, when I look back on it afterwards, I don't think I was ready to experience, you know, the demanding level of training, but also the demanding nature of the coach in the way he spoke to the players and being away from family and friends. So it all contributed. And then I played in the first game, started, got taken off at halftime, and then didn't play again until the end of the year. So there was a lot of different factors. But I think, you know, that resilience piece, which we spoke about a bit earlier, you need to be ready because it's cutthroat over there. And, you know, you're not just competing against other Australian players, obviously, you're competing against, you know, Dutch players, German players, Swedish players, African players. And they're all fighting. They're all fighting to get that new contract or that next contract or get a move somewhere else. And you have to be okay with I guess that side of things. Otherwise, you just won't survive over there.
And I suppose on top of that, not that they're just players from all over the world, but some of them, I guess a lot of them might be seasoned professionals and have played at that level for 10 years. So for them like that, you're in that routine, you know what's expected. So for you to come in, it's very difficult, isn't it, at a young age?
Yeah, most definitely. And I think it's great. It's great for young Australian players to move overseas. There's no right time to do it. I think it's tough. And you look at now how much the NPL players train and they've got, you know, the youth team set up. So a lot of A-League clubs have got academies and they play in the NPL. So there was a lot of things that weren't around back then, which were against us players. When now, you know, you train a lot more, you play a lot more games. So hopefully the ones that do go over, they are more conditioned to be able to handle that. And even the training, I think I've noticed it definitely has gotten harder over the years because I think they realize they can maybe push more. So that's good as well.
Yeah. And then it does, I mean, I say this quite a lot, but when you do get to that level, you know, everyone's fit, everyone's fast, everyone's strong. You're all good players, obviously, when you get to that level. So I do think the mentality of it, and you touched on it before, is so, so important now to get your mind right. I know you do a lot of work on it, which we'll touch on. But how did you find that? Because obviously, you know, I think most players in the world at some point have been hauled off at halftime because you might not be performing. But to go overseas and play your first game and get taken off at halftime and not play again, like, how difficult was that to get through?
Yeah, it was horrible. It was, I guess, a nightmare, like I spoke about, you know, at the start. You know, we wanted to pick a club where I thought I was going to play a lot at, and a good environment in the way. And there was a lot of things that went wrong with those discussions looking back now, in terms of, you know, what they're saying and what actually kind of happened. And for sure, some of that's on, you know, on how I trained and how I handled the situation. But then also, you know, the coach saying you want to play a certain way and what we're going to do, and not being able to implement that stuff. And you know, he ended up getting sacked right towards the end of the year, and we ended up getting relegated. So it was disappointing in terms of that. But just, I think, being on the other side of the world, you know, being left out of the team week after week, or being on the bench and not coming on, I think you just, you start to question yourself. You start to, I guess, lose belief in yourself. You lose motivation. I wouldn't say I was completely depressed, but, you know, it was hard to get out of bed in the morning to go to training. Sometimes you didn't enjoy it. And, you know, there's so many of these elements where, you know, if you're back home in Australia, you got your friends, you got your family, life outside of it's quite good. So, you know, even if you're not playing on the field, you've still got other things you can do to try and, you know, put you in a good mood. Where over there, you know, I didn't go to Holland for, you know, for anything besides football. So if that wasn't going well, then, you know, what am I doing here? So if I went back now, I would enjoy those other things outside of football, because you've got to have that balance. If things aren't going well with football, doesn't mean your life has to be shit as such as well. You know, you can enjoy things, and don't get me wrong, I still went, and, you know, my wife now, who was my girlfriend back then, she was over for parts of it, and we went and visited different places, and but my general mood and well-being was poor, and I was talking about the same thing all the time about how bad it was, and the coach is poor. And I think, you know, I needed to look at myself as well and be like, you know what, it's tough, it's hard, and it's going to be tough for the rest of this season, but go out there and give 100% every day. And even if you don't some days because it's so hard to, you know what, you go again the next day. And I think, I didn't have any coping mechanisms back then, and we didn't have a lot of help at all the A-League teams that I'd been at, Adelaide and Melbourne City. They never really provided any resources for this. And even at the AIS, never been exposed to kind of handle those situations. So I guess, you know, why would I be able to? And I'm not saying mine was that much worse than other people's, but it was a tough year and a tough coach. It could have been different with another coach. But I think also those learning experiences, I'm so happy that they did happen, because it's made me into the person and the player that I am today.
Yeah, definitely. And as you say, it's, you know, back then around all the clubs and probably in any clubs worldwide, that sort of, you know, mental side of the game or having sports psychologist wasn't really a thing. Whereas now I know it's a lot more prevalent, it's a lot more available to people. So who did you sort of speak to outside of your girlfriend? Like, as you said, you're over there by yourself, struggling, hating it, just like, what am I doing here? You know, was it your parents you talked to? Was it your agent, your wife, your girlfriend at the time? But is that's the only sort of support, I guess, you have, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, I think at that moment, that was kind of all you really had. And also, I probably didn't want to speak too much about it with people back home, because I was probably embarrassed by it as well. You know, you're meant to be living your dream. You're a professional footballer, but, you know, if you're not playing, I guess that's where that whole identity thing comes into it. And, you know, if you're not playing, you kind of lose that self-worth and think, well, you know, what's going on here? I didn't want to share that I was struggling, because then it maybe looked like I was weak, where now you look at it and you think, no, it's more of a sign of strength. And, you know, asking for help or speaking to people it's being smart. It's not being strong to kind of keep it into yourself. So I think, you know, for young players, yes, there's more clubs that are investing in sports psychologists, but still nowhere at the level that I think it should be. And even if it's not sports psychologists, but just having an element of training sessions, or when you're in academies or NPL teams, having practices in place to work on the players' mental side of their game, as much as the physical, as much as the technical, which but when I email clubs and ask them about it or speak to different people I know, I think maybe one or two have said they've got something, and I don't know if I even believe them if they do. So it's quite astonishing that, you know, we are in 2023 and you hear everybody talk about how important it is, but I don't know if many players are actually getting educated on this. And then some people that I do speak to in the academy space, they seem to think the players are actually getting worse mentally, probably because of the demands of social media and, you know, maybe not being as resilient as what we were back in the day, because we've probably tried to wrap the kids in cotton wool and make everything easy and successful for them. So now they are getting these challenges. So yes, it's improved in probably the top level. They get everything, but majority of the A-League teams that I've been at over here in Japan, even they're a bit behind, and then the old teams that I know of, it's not looked at upon enough, in my opinion anyway.
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely. And as we say, it's so important now. And you know, with the addition of social media as well, which like that, most people didn't have to deal with 5 to 10 years ago as much as it is now, which is just another added stress that you're constantly seeing. Like if you're on the bench, like if you just imagine that you're back there in NEC, but the team lists come up on Instagram every single week and you're not on it. You know, it's an added pressure of everyone then knows that you're struggling. I know what you mean.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you know what? If you want to be a professional athlete, life's tough anyway. And there's always going to be different things that come up. But if you want to be a professional athlete, you have to learn to be okay with that struggle, because every day is a battle. Every day you're getting told, whether it's directly or indirectly, I rate you or I don't rate you. You're good enough for the starting 11 or you're not good enough. And it's hard. And it's, you know, then like you said, the team list comes out, or you get told if you're in the squad or not. Again, you know, it's another kind of disappointment, and it's tough to handle, but that's part of it. So instead of trying to, you know, wrap them in cotton wool when they're younger, which I think, you know, especially in Australia, we're looking to do now, why not just teach them how to actually handle those setbacks, and teach them, you know, this is going to happen. So when it does happen, you can do X, Y, and Z to actually overcome it. And even then it's going to be hard, but you know, when you come out the other end, you'll be stronger for it and you'll be able to handle it.
Yeah, so given what you've just said then, and we have this conversation a lot, you know, locally, we've all got the NPL up here and young kids. You know, I think up until the age of under 16 here now through the NPL, especially in Queensland, the mandate is everyone has to have equal time, you know, which I can understand from a development point of view. But if you're used to getting equal time, whether you train well or not, and like that, you make that move to Europe, that's going to be a massive shock to your system that all of a sudden I haven't played all season, or I've played 30 minutes and been hauled off and the coach doesn't speak to me. You know what I mean? It's something that's really, really missed, I feel.
Yeah, like they've obviously got their practices in place for a reason. And I understand, you know, you've got parents that are paying, you know, pretty large fees to play in the NPL. So, you know, they're probably complaining if their child's not playing. But, you know, there has to be an age group where I think that stops. And if you'll want to be in the top, the NPL, where it's competitive, yes, it's about development 100%, but you know what, you develop pretty quickly if you're getting told you're not training well enough and you drop from the team. You know, your attitude's going to have to change pretty quickly. And as long as the coach is actually giving information on why you're not playing, giving feedback on that, for me, that learning experience is invaluable. And if anything, that kid is going to improve, or hopefully improve so much from that. Or you know what, maybe they quit. And of course, you don't want to lose players from the game, but if they want to make it at that top level, they're going to have to learn to handle that. And if they don't want that, then they can drop back down to the JPL or the B team. I don't know what it is now. And they can have fun. They can still enjoy football. They can, you know, kick around with their mates. And that's great, because, you know, football's not for everyone at that top level. Not everyone wants to be a professional athlete. But if you do, I think you should be preparing them for the reality of it, and it's a results-based business, you know, where we're essentially just a pawn in this big game. And whether it's, you know, me, Stefan Mork playing for Fujiano Okayama and scoring the winning goal, or if it's someone else the next week, in the big scheme of things, the club honestly doesn't care. You know, they care about winning games, being a profitable business, hopefully, So you as a player have to understand a little bit that, you know, you have to produce, and you know what, you're going to get dropped, you're going to get cut, you're not going to get a new contract. How are you going to handle that situation? Because it's going to happen, and it's going to happen a lot in your career.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. It's yeah, very important and like that. It's a subject that you could talk about for hours, but we'll move on. With your playing side of it, so what comes to the end of the first year in Holland and you've been relegated, what sort of happens then? Where did you go from there, and how did those sort of moves and discussions come about?
Yeah, so I guess I tried to leave in January of that season, and I was halfway through, and I had a move to the English Championship that I thought was pretty much over the line. Vinny was saying, yeah, no, say goodbye to people, pack your bags. Looking at houses online, me and my girlfriend, and then a couple of hours later, he said, just wait for the phone call and then be ready. I ended up getting a call saying, listen, they've just got an injury for another player. They need to sign a different position, so it's not going to go ahead. And I was like, well, this is that level of embarrassment walking back into the club the next day was something that I'll never forget, of being like, one, I didn't want to be there to begin with, but then you've said goodbye to people and that you're getting a move, and then it doesn't happen. They're thinking, what's going on with this guy? Like, he just said he was leaving. So that was horrible. And I was still trying to get a move somewhere else, but nothing ended up coming up. I was literally waiting by the phone until the last second of the deadline day. And unfortunately, nothing came about. And that was just through, I guess, like Vince couldn't get anything at the end of the day. You know, whether the clubs weren't interested in me, you know, you rely on the agent to get you something. And if they don't, you know, of course, you're disappointed, but you move on and stay the rest of the season, like you said. And then once we got relegated, we were in the relegation playoffs. I actually ended up playing, once the coach got sacked with two games to go, came off the bench for the last couple, and came off the bench in one of the playoffs as well. But we lost to NAC Breda, and straight away it was just, yeah, it's disappointment. One, I guess, you know, you saw the fans. We actually, for our last playoff game, it was two legs. The second leg was at home. They actually, in the lead up to that game, they kind of barricaded in the change rooms, their windows, so with wood, because in the previous 3 or 4 years when they did get relegated, that got smashed in, and the fans were trying to get into the club. And I was thinking, this is insane. So they were getting ready for that in case we did lose and go down. But we were stuck in the change room for maybe an hour and a half after the game, 2 hours, until the police had kind of cleared people out. Just shows how much they care about football. And for them, it was a disaster. It was, you know, they're in the second division now. And they didn't accept that. They wanted better than that. So it was one of those things where, yeah, you're disappointed. But again, you know, you're looking out for your own future. And for me, that was then, all right, I need to get a move to another team, which, looking back now, I actually wish that I did stay in the second division. I thought, you know what, my wages were going down by 25%, which I didn't like. but, you know, I thought it's not a good level. I need to just get back to playing. And I got an offer from Melbourne City to come on loan, which was not bad money, better money, but I thought it was a better opportunity at the time after speaking to the coach. You know, hindsight's great. And looking back now, I wish I did stay, because I was hoping they were going to get promoted that year, and then I was going to go back because I had another year after that. They ended up losing in the promotion playoffs, and yeah, it didn't work out too well at Melbourne City. It was okay, but I didn't do well enough to get a move back overseas. So it was overall quite disappointing how it worked out. But that was, yeah, that's what happens, I guess, when I could have stayed if I wanted to, and the club actually wanted me to stay. I forced through a move because I wanted to leave, because I thought that was the right thing to do. And you know what? If I went to Melbourne City and played better and scored 3 or 4 more goals, who knows? Things could have turned out differently, but it didn't. And I think, you know, looking back now, it's very tough to get to Europe. So when you do get there, you need to stick it out. And even if you do get relegated or something happens, you know, financially you do take a hit. But being over in Europe, you're in the shop window. It's much better to be over there than to be in Australia, because when you're in Australia, it's so hard to get out of Australia that when you do get out, you want to stay out, because when you come back again, you've got the same problem. It's tough to get out again.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the most important things, especially when you get to that level, and you're not playing his playing time. And I know what you mean. You picked it over here to come back and play. But as you say, maybe dropping down a division is not ideal, but to get you, you know, potentially 90 minutes every week in the second division, you know, might be a better option sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, they play a lot more games over there. Still, you know, it's in Europe. So I think we had Arnaud Danjuma, who's actually now at Everton. He was on loan last year at Tottenham. He plays for the Dutch national team. He was at NEC then. And, you know, he went down to the second division, was unbelievable. I think he was player of the year in that tournament. Then he got sold to Club Bruges in Belgium for a couple of million. Mm-hmm. So it's still possible to get moves from that. I guess I just didn't think it was a good enough level. And you know what? Overall, the A-League is better, much better than that second division. But you're over there in the shop window, and if you're one of the best players, you're still more likely to get a better move. And yeah, I don't regret anything because, you know, there's no point regretting things. But, you know, giving advice to someone if they were in that position like me, I'd say to just, you know what, stay over there. Don't worry about the A-League. You know what, maybe you get an extra $50,000 or $100,000, whatever it is. You're not going to be rich off that. But being over in Europe is what you want. So stay over there and stick it out.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's good advice, especially as you say, it's difficult to get that initial move as an Aussie. We see more and more of it now, which is good. But yeah, once you're there, stay there and, you know, work hard. Yeah. As you say, it's going to be tough, but it'll be worth it in the long run because like that, you just need one good season or 10 or 15 good games and you never know who's watching and who comes in for you.
Exactly right. And like you said, it has changed. I think the landscape, Australian players, you know, the way of, you know, obviously social media, but just technology so you can watch all the games. Mm. But then beyond that, you've got all these, you know, stats that are a Moneyball kind of way of trying to sign players, you know, value for money. Australia is a great market for that because they don't have to pay ridiculous transfer fees. And now they can actually judge the league standard, where back then they would have said, oh, Australia, it's not a good level. But now they can actually compare the two leagues side by side based on all these stats of, you know, the intensity of it, the quality of it, quality of the player. So it's a much better market to be in Australia now than probably what it was 10 years ago when I was a young player. But it's still, once you get over there, you want to stay in Europe because, you know, it's more challenging, it's harder, it's more difficult. But if you want to make it over there, you have to be able to handle that side of it.
Yeah. And we'll touch on then, so we've had obviously a difficult experience there. You came back to Australia and played for, was it Melbourne, Adelaide again, and then you obviously had a time at Brisbane, and then Japan, which we'll get onto. So how was your time sort of back here, and how did your Japanese move come around?
Yeah, so I went after Melbourne City the lone year. I signed for Brisbane. They actually bought me from the Dutch team, and I signed a long-term contract there thinking things were going to work out well, and ended up getting injured in the first year in pre-season, like just before the season started, hurt my groins from a kind of an overload injury, which wasn't great. And then I ended up missing that whole season. And then after that, played a little bit that next year, but I just wasn't enjoying it. And Adelaide came back in. And I thought, you know what, I need a fresh start, and went back to Adelaide. And that's where things kind of picked up and worked really well, and became the youngest captain for the club and played a really good season. And then got a phone call or a message from an agent just saying, listen, there's a Japanese team that's looking for a player. I've put your name forward. You know, so then they worked with Vince to get that deal across the line. It was I had a buyout clause again with Adelaide, but they were quite reluctant to let me go, and I think the Japanese team wanted to pay a little bit below that, so it was that was challenging to try and, I guess, force that move through. But you know, financially, it was a good move to come over to here to Japan, but it was probably more so I wanted to test myself overseas again after that Dutch experience. I wanted to, you know, all the things that I'd been working on from my mental side of my game and the things that I'd learned from that experience, I wanted to test it out. And, you know, I'm so grateful for Adelaide for letting me come and for giving me the opportunity to, I guess, you know, start to play well again. And, you know, the year and 9 months that I've been here has been so much more challenging than that Dutch experience, I think, just the way that things have worked out over here. But I'm able to handle the situations and you know, I'm going well. I'm playing pretty regularly, whether I'm starting or coming off the bench. It's quite a competitive squad, but you know, things are going well. And because of that experience, I was a lot more equipped to handle this second time around.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine. So I suppose a very different challenge with it being, you know, in a very foreign country. Obviously, Holland's a foreign country, but you'd imagine Japan, just completely different culture, language, food. How did you sort of cope with all of that initially? Was that a huge sort of culture shock?
Yeah, I think it was tough. I think the first, again, you know, you're kind of running on adrenaline the first couple of weeks. You get over here, you're kind of just buzzing to be here. And I was lucky Mitch Duke, who played for Fagiano for a year and a half, was here at the time. We were living in the same apartment block as well. So he was a massive, massive help for me in the beginning. But after that kind of wears off, you know, it is tough. You know, you go to the supermarkets and you don't know what a lot of things are. Of course, you think you know what something is, but everything's different. Obviously, the language for one, but the images they put on there, the what you think is maybe, I don't know, chicken is maybe not chicken, or you think, you know, something is milk and it's not. You just got no idea because it's in a different language. Everything's different. So you kind of, luckily we've got technology with Google Translate, taking photos of everything to see what it is, or just getting used to it. But, you know, those small mundane things that were so easy to do and you take for granted, you can't, you know, you go to a cafe trying to order a coffee is difficult. And, you know, the city I'm in, Okayama, is a small city. It's a million people, but for Japan, it's small and it's a, you know, there's not a lot of people that speak English, so it's tough. And, you know, you have to be able to handle that side of it because, you know, you're at the training ground for maybe 5 hours, but, you know, the other 17, 18 hours, 19 hours of the day that you aren't at the training ground, you're in Japan and you've got to be able to handle that side of things. And if you're unhappy off the field, then normally you're probably going to be unhappy on the field. So you're trying to create an environment that you're comfortable with and you can – yeah, enjoy your life off the field. So then when you get to training, you're ready to go.
And have you, just on the language side, have you started, or you've been there for a while, but have you learned Japanese yourself, or do you know enough? Have you learned enough to get by?
I've learned a little bit to get by, but then I've probably just learned better how to speak broken English and broken Japanese. So they kind of understand what I'm saying to get away with most things, or Google Translate. But yeah, it's tough, and hopefully, you know, I'm here for a couple more years, and I started taking some lessons at the beginning of this year, and probably next season as well, I'll take that a bit more seriously with wherever I end up. Hopefully it's in Japan. But yeah, I think it's important to learn it just a little bit, just so you can get by, that's for sure.
Yeah. And the initial thing that you said around another agent had reached out to you, were they an agent in the Asian region, or was that another Australian agent that had reached out to you?
I was another Australian agent, yeah.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So they just reached out and sort of put your name forward, obviously thought you were a good player. And because you're represented by Vince, you just put those two in touch to sort of make something happen.
Yeah. So I think, you know, a lot of different deals can come about. It depends where you are, Asia, Europe, every kind of probably continent, country has got their own way of dealing with things. But being over here, it was more he had a contact with a Japanese agent. He did a few deals over to Japan, so it was more so that, you know, he knew the club were looking for a player, an Asian player in my position, and yeah, he rated me as a player, thought I could come here and do well. So that's yeah, that's how it came about. And then, you know, the two agents speak to each other, and, you know, they obviously financially need to both be happy with what they're getting, and that's kind of where it can become a bit tricky. But I was kind of just like, listen, I don't really care who's doing the deal. For me, it's about getting over there, and you guys need to sort that stuff out. As long as that worked well, you know, everybody's happy. And I think that's what it should always be. It should be, well, what's best for the player. But it doesn't always happen like that. You know, there's probably been a lot of situations where moves didn't happen because of agents weren't happy with what they were getting, or weren't getting a cut, so they didn't want the deal to go through. So that's where it can become a bit shady, but I've been fortunate that all my dealings have been pretty positive with agents.
And then with going to Holland, you had a German passport. When going into Japan, was that a bit more difficult on an Australian passport, or how did you find that?
It would have been extremely simple if there wasn't this thing called COVID, but because of that, it delayed everything. So I signed a pre-agreement in November of the last year I was in the A-League, and was meant to leave in January, was it maybe January 10th or something like that. And I didn't end up leaving until the start of March because the borders in Japan were closed. And if you didn't have a visa, you couldn't come in, and no new visas were getting given out, regardless of if you, you know, you had a job or you had a contract, you know, they weren't giving them out. So it was quite a stressful period because I wasn't actually sure if the deal was going to go through or they were just going to pull the pin on it. Even though now, knowing what I know, it was always going to happen. It was just when I was going to kind of come here. But yeah, it was quite a stressful period because you didn't know actually what was happening. And then I was still playing for Adelaide. There's obviously a lot of rumors out there, and negotiating with Adelaide, negotiating with the Japanese club to kind of extend my contract with Adelaide and kind of giving written permission that I could play the games and I could train, because then you've got injury compensation or if I insurance. So it was a very strange set of circumstances, but, you know, luckily didn't get injured. Everything worked out okay, and I got here in the end. But the visa process, you know, the club should take care of all of that stuff. You know, if you're a young player looking to go on trial, different scenario then. But if you're signing for a club, they really should be taking care of all of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Now, that would have been a stressful couple of months. I know. What a time to sign. What a time for that to happen.
Yeah, exactly. But now we're in the clear, and thankfully there's hopefully, touch wood, there's not going to be any more situations like that in my career anyway.
No, definitely not. And how have you found, I guess, integrating with your squad? You've obviously been there a while now, but firstly integrating, is there many foreigners there? And how did you find the sort of language barrier within your teammates and your coaching staff?
Yeah, we've got five foreigners, so it was the same last year and same this year. Only four can play, which makes it quite tough. One's always going to miss out in the squad. But yeah, they're all really good. All of the foreigners, we all speak English. There's a Korean boy that's not the best English speaker, but we get away with it. And speaking to the Japanese players, it is hard. You know, a lot of them don't speak great English at all. Obviously, I don't speak great Japanese, so it's interesting how, you know, you change the way you speak. Obviously, speaking slower, you know, less words. And if you're a fly on the wall hearing some of our conversations, you probably laugh and think that doesn't make any sense. But that's how you communicate, because you both kind of know how each other is talking and what you're talking about through just repetition, probably more than anything. But yeah, that's probably the other part of being overseas. It can be tough as well if you're in a foreign speaking country, and especially Japan's. It's really tough. Japan, South Korea, probably China. You know, they're all similar, where, you know, there's not a lot of English speaking people, especially in the smaller cities. You lose that connection with your teammates and even with the coaching staff as well. We've got a translator, so, you know, that's important from the coaching side of things, and getting help. That's a massive help. But yeah, you don't hang out with your teammates as much because it's not that enjoyable, because you can't speak, you can't communicate. So, you know, there is these things off the field that are different, but, you know, you just learn to accept that. That's the way it is.
And on the field, things are going well. You were saying before, so you guys are challenging now for the top six for the playoffs. You're in J2, obviously. How have you found, not, I suppose, the level, like the level of football, but the atmospheres around the stadiums in J2 and the different cities you go to? How have you found all that experience?
Yeah, it's been amazing. I guess, you know, there's, you know, when you're in Australia, you kind of know all the teams, you know all the cities. But coming here, it's, you know Tokyo, you know Osaka, maybe Kyoto. But after that, you know, I don't think many people could name any Japanese cities. So, yeah, it's been quite cool. You know, we've got 22 teams in the league, 21 away games, so it's a lot of traveling. And that's probably something that, you know, there's 8 games to go. I think we've got 4 more away trips. You know, you get tired of it because it's a lot of time spent on buses, trains, planes. But it is great to see the different cities, see how the people live there, the stadiums. A lot of their stadiums here, especially in J2, are like the old athletics tracks around the outside, which isn't great for the atmosphere. You know, but you play in some other really cool stadiums as well. So, you know, overall it's great. I think the level's quite high. It's a different style of football than Australia. J2 from J1 is also very different as well. You know, J1 is probably actually an easier, level in terms of the way the game's played. It's, you know, there's better quality players, so you get punished, but, you know, it's more tactical. Where J2, it's just up and down, physical. The players are just going 100 miles an hour. So, you know, it's been great to experience it. And, yeah, like I said earlier, I'm hoping I'll be able to extend my stay here in Japan, and hopefully that will happen.
And how have you found, I know your wife's there with you as well, how has she settled in this sort of environment? And it's obviously going to be a lot easier having her there with you.
Yeah, it's a lot easier, and I'm probably fortunate as well that she's where she was working, her company actually has kept her on, so she's able to still work from Japan or fly back to Australia. Because I think if she wasn't working, she's someone that's very career focused as well, and enjoys working, enjoys you know, being successful in her domain. So I think, you know, that's helped us, because if she was stuck here at home all day waiting for me to get home from training, she would get bored very quickly, and maybe I wouldn't be talking about looking to extend my stay, would maybe be planning to come back to Australia, to be honest, because it is tough. But, you know, she's handled it well, and, you know, you do get homesick and you do miss small things, and, you know, I'm very grateful for the sacrifice she's made coming over here. You know, and you know, there is times where you think, you know, I can't wait to get out of here, I can't wait for the off season. But, you know, it was the same last off season when we got back. We're like, you know what, we're ready to go back to Japan, and we're actually grateful of all these great memories and experiences that we're doing together, because Australia is always going to be there. But, you know, what you learn over here and the different people you meet and the different way of living is exciting as well.
Yeah, no, but I can imagine it would just be another added pressure, as you say. If things are going well off the field, it can help you just focus on the field. And if there's it can be difficult if you've got a partner there that doesn't have much else going on apart from sort of just hanging around waiting for you. You can see how that could add a bit of extra pressure. So that's good that it's been able to work out, and no doubt helps both of you, which is great.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, what is there to, especially in a smaller city like this, there's not a whole lot to do. So then she's probably just going out and doing a lot more shopping, which isn't good for the bank account either. So probably lucky she's got a job.
And one of the things, talking about the sort of, you know, the bank account there, I know we came across it, and this is just something for other people to be aware of, but your contract itself is one of those ones that's, it's signed in US dollars with a US dollar value, but then you get paid in Japanese yen. So it's quite interesting, because I've noticed that now a little bit more in Asia, the more players that I speak to, that it's quite common that that's happening.
Yeah, I think depends on the club and depends on probably what you've really demand in the contract. And that's something for my next contracts I'll make sure doesn't happen. But I guess for the clubs, it's their preference. You know, they've got yen. So if they have to exchange yen to US, then depending on the exchange rate, you know, you always lose a bit of money here or there. It's worse for the club. So, yeah, it's something that in the timing that I've been here, it's worked out extremely poorly, because the yen is going down in value and the US dollar is getting quite strong. So I think it's just being aware of, you know, when you're speaking to the agents, you know, all right, it's in US dollars, but what am I getting paid in? And if they say that they're going to pay you in their local currency, can you demand that they pay in the other one? The other thing was that the bank that they were setting me up with for the bank account didn't accept any foreign currency. So it wasn't possible to at that moment. But now that I know, I would demand that, you know, I don't go with that bank. I go and use a different bank that allows me to have that, because why do I want yen? Obviously, yes, you know, to spend while you're here, but you'd much prefer to be getting paid in US dollars than yen. That's just the reality of this situation, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it is. It's a good thing, as we say, it's something we're coming across like that, just chatting to people, and it's just another thing along with visas and agents that's very important to be aware of, and it could be a little thing that like that you just don't know about, and your bank was one of them. You know, we wouldn't have known. You didn't know about the not receiving foreign currencies in. So it's good little, again, it's just something you learn as you go along, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, nobody was doing bad by anyone in the situation. It was just the way it was. Nobody knew the yen was going to, you know, depreciate in the time that I was here. But, you know, if you can safeguard yourself from those situations and make it easier, you know, you have to do that. But unless you kind of go through it or you hear about it, you're not going to know. So I think that's just the questions you got to ask at the start. from the agents, whoever's doing it, you know, ask as many questions as you can if you're not sure about something. There's no silly question, and you just got to keep asking until you get the answers that you want and that you're happy with. And you know what? Sometimes, you know what? You might not be happy with it because they say, we're not paying you in US, we're paying you in yen. That's the end of it. And you just have to either accept that or don't sign the deal. So I think that's the way it is.
Yeah, that's it. At least you know. That's it. You know, and that's what we're trying to do, I guess, with a lot of these podcasts and interviews is just help educate the next people that might never have thought about something like this and just make it something to put on their notes of things to ask. Well, we've covered a lot. I won't hold you up much longer, but before we do, I'll let you talk a little bit about the Inner Games journals, because I know you do a lot of work on that, and obviously the experiences you've had between, you know, Europe, Australia, and now Japan, they've no doubt been a huge help to you. So feel free to give us a speech on what they are, you know, why you've sort of created this and who they're aimed at.
Yeah, so I guess probably all stemmed from that real big struggle in Holland. I started to look into the mind and kind of improving my own mindset and ways that I could cope. And over the next couple of years, I developed this journal, which then turned into the Inner Game journals. And through COVID, had a bit of extra spare time, so had that time to start the business and understand how something besides football works. You know, how to create the journal, how to get us, you know, the suppliers from overseas or, you know, in Australia, all those basic things, which was great. But I guess the main focus of the journal was to, you know, allow players to, I guess, start to set goals, reflect on their performance and kind of, you know, take their own career into their own hands, because, you know, you're not always going to have a great coach or a mentor or someone that's there to help you, but, you know, you're always got the information and I guess success leaves clues, but also, you know, failures leaves a lot of clues as well. So, you know, looking into your past wins or things to improve on, you know, can help you for what you need to work on. Talking about the challenges that I've experienced and that probably led into workshops, which I didn't plan to at the start, but there was a bit of a demand for it. Speaking to clubs, you know, state teams, schools, whatever it was. Then, you know, turned into creating an app, because that was kind of the way that it was heading to, and that's now in at a few different organizations, which is pretty cool. And then putting the workshops, rather than just being in person, putting them, you know, on an online web portal so people can log in on demand and watch them whenever they want, plus doing some one-on-one mentoring. It's kind of expanded into different things along the way, which is exciting, but also a lot more work than probably what I realized it was going to be when I started out. But that's all part of it, and it's all really exciting. So I'm, you know, I really just want to, you know, inspire that next generation and I guess create that self-awareness from within them, to be mindful athletes, to understand what they need to do on the field, to understand what they need to do off the field. And it doesn't just have to be for professional athletes, but I think it's really just for any athlete, because whatever they do post being an athlete, after school, university, TAFE, whatever it may be, you know, these skills are transferable. So I really just want to, you know, I want to create athletes or young humans that are resilient and kind of can be the best they can be. And that's really what I'm passionate about. And hopefully I'll be able to get into more organizations along the way. And the app, I think, will be the real big winner, along with the workshops, because of, you know, the ability for coaches to now give feedback through the app to players, the players to obviously rate themselves. But hopefully you're eliminating a lot of the issues that do happen at, you know, local NPL clubs, because the feedback element seems to be the number one thing that comes up at every single club that I speak to, from, you know, coaches' side, players' side, parents' side. Nobody seems to be getting feedback, and it's no blame on the coaches or the players or the parents, because these coaches are part-time. But if you can give them a resource to do that and give the players feedback, then they know what they need to work on, and the parents are happy. And then hopefully at the end of the season, if, you know, someone is getting cut or told they're not going to be kept on, at least they've known throughout the year why and what they weren't working on, and hopefully then they can take that forward going to the next club as well. So that's it in a nutshell. You know, it's really just focusing on the mental side of the game, which I think is a neglected part of the junior football landscape. But we'll see with time how many clubs want to adopt it in, or how many are just happy with what they're doing.
No, it's fantastic. And as we've sort of touched on, I guess, many times through this this conversation is that mental side of the game. And for youngsters, you know, looking to make that move to professional sports and like that, whether it's football or another sport, no doubt, you know, journaling is a huge helpful tool for that, and feedback, you know, just to improve. You're going to have setbacks, as you say, but if you can continue to improve and get that feedback and work on those areas, no doubt it can just be something else to help you, you know, sort of achieve those dreams.
Yeah, exactly right. Like, I think that's, you know, it started out when I was doing it was really just to help the individual athletes, because I think they're the most important thing. But then realizing, well, it's much easier if I can get into a club or get into an organization. They've got all the junior athletes, so maybe they want to invest in it as well, so they can help their athletes out. So now hopefully I'm helping the two. But really, yeah, you know, I think it's just about, you know, educating them and really just teaching them the basic stuff that, you know, what I think now is normal. But it's only normal for me because I've, you know, been in the system for 12, 13, 14 years and experienced all of this. A lot of people don't know what I would consider basic knowledge in this field. So hopefully I can spread the message on it and help, you know, help the young kids improve, stay involved with sport, because, you know, the well-being side of it, you know, is massive when you see the statistics on kids that play sport. And that's probably what it comes down to as well, is, you know, you fall out of love with sport because you probably don't see improvement or you're having challenges. But, you know, if you can always be improving the players, they're not all going to make it professionally. But if they stay involved with sport, the well-being and improvement on their mental health from that side of things is massive. So there's two elements to it, I guess, with the performance aspect, but then also just your general well-being as well and staying involved with sport.
Yeah, no, amazing. No, well, Stefan, thank you very, very much for your time today. I really appreciate it, and I think a lot of people will get a lot of great insights out of this chat. So thank you very much.
No worries. Thanks very much, Chris.
Perfect, man. That was awesome.